Let's go back to Mark 13. I didn't even realize it until Kirk expounded on the Heidelberg Catechism at the beginning, but providence is a great lens for Mark 13. Mark 13, if it is about anything that everybody can agree on, it's about the future. What future it is, how far out or how close, what exactly that future will look like, there is a lot of debate, but Mark 13 is really the first time in Jesus' ministry that he has primarily looked, not to the past and what God has promised and done, or the present and what is going on right here and now, but to the future. And so this is going to be our main topic. I hope that in the times to come, the seasons, years to come, that maybe we can come back to this theme and do a series on it, the future, what traditionally Christians would call eschatology. Eschatos is the Greek word for last. And so the last things, the ultimate things, death, resurrection, judgment, heaven and hell, the life of the world to come, all of this is important in the Christian faith. And this is where Jesus talks about, at least in a sense, these things more directly than anywhere else in Mark. But for the sake of time, because we need to do all of Mark 13 just today, what I want to do, instead of getting lost in a detail here or a controversial debate there, I want to kind of think big picture about what is going on in this chapter. And just to start, Kirk has already set us up well. I think probably for all of us, in the last year or so, we are about a year into the shutdown, at least here in New York City with COVID-19, that we all feel probably in a more intense an obvious way than we have in previous seasons of our life, how the present is impacted when the future either becomes completely murky or even dark and ominous, or at the very least, you feel stuck, like the future is just out there. I think very clearly part of the reason this season has been hard for almost all of us in the world, in our country, is because the joy, the energy, the sense of orientation that we usually take from our perception of what's coming in the future has been taken away from us. We don't know how long it will be until the world goes back to something like normal. We haven't known for a while, and we don't even know what that will look like. We don't know how long it will last. We don't know what the economy will look like. We don't know what our own personal habits of wearing masks and greeting one another and gathering together. We don't know what the final toll will be on multiple levels of this or what will be coming. And so the futures we all envisioned, even for these last 12 months, let alone a year from now, 5 years from now, has been put on hold. There's a great movie based on a brilliant novel by P.D. James that I thought a lot about this past year called The Children of Men. Some of you have probably seen it. And the whole story is this kind of apocalyptic story, which that's a good word for Mark 13. It's apocalyptic, which is just from a Greek word that means to reveal or to unveil. It's a story set in the not too distant future in which human beings, for some mysterious reason, have become incapable of giving birth to human beings anymore. And so a human being has not been born in the world for about 18 years when this story picks up. And unless something happens, the entire human race is about to disappear in the next generation or two. And the whole movie, the whole story is about how that loss of our future and what we thought was our future completely paralyzes who we are in the present. It makes having significance, meaning, hope in the here and now impossible. We all live, whether we're aware of it or not, off of a sense of what is coming. We all perceive, whether with hope or despair, the shape of things to come. We might be confident about what is coming. We might be murky about it. But all of us are, I often say this over the years, that the way we remember the past and the way we anticipate the future, you could almost put it in like a simple mathematical formula. The way you remember the past and the way you anticipate the future equals the way that you perceive and experience here and now. And so this is a passage about the future, and it's a passage that is about our future and every generation. And that's an important thing. And so what do we do? And even to make this very practical, when we read the Gospels as Christians, I think that we should often ask this question, what relevance does this have for us today? This story of what happened with people we never met long ago in a culture completely different from us, what relevance does the story of Jesus still have for us today? And part of the answer to that is the relevance that it will always have for the future still to come. And so especially in this season, I suspect that hearing a word from Jesus about how we can trust God for our future is an important word for us to hear. And so I want us to see the big picture here rather than get lost in a couple of details that we just don't have time for. So what I want to do in the time that we have is three things. The first is I just want to spend a couple of moments talking about how this genre of what's often called apocalyptic, where you have this kind of end of the world imagery of sun going dark, of stars falling from heaven, of the moon not giving its light, of earthquakes and kind of end of the world imagery, how this works in the Old Testament, in the New Testament. This is one of those genres that we have almost no analogy and no parallel for anymore in our culture. And so especially us as modern people, we are often, I think, either confused or even tempted to hear something in this genre that's not there and to miss what is there. I'm often reminded when I read passages like this of something C.S. Lewis once said. When somebody came up to him, you know, here's C.S. Lewis, he's this, you know, really well-known, brilliant don and scholar at Oxford and Cambridge at different parts of his life. And yet, in the second half of his adult life, was known very publicly as being an Orthodox Christian, which for many people in our culture, it's like you can be brilliant or you can be an Orthodox Christian, but you can't be both. And so somebody comes up to him at some point in his life and says, C.S. Lewis, are you one of those Christians who reads the Bible literally? And you can kind of hear the trap that's waiting there for him. Are you one of these dumb, stupid Christians who reads the Bible literally? And he gave the best short response to that I've ever heard, so I often use it. And he said, I don't read the Bible literally. I read it seriously. That is, I read it according to the intention of the author, and so I read poems as poems. And I read stories as stories, and I read history as history, and I read worship psalms as worship psalms, and I read wisdom literature as wisdom literature. And so when Jesus tells his disciples to be as innocent as doves, I have never been tempted to think that he meant that we're supposed to lay eggs, right? We read the Bible seriously, not literally. And the point is, what is the intention of the author when imagery like this is used? And probably in the follow-up writing that I always do midweek in the season, I'll send out some more passages on this. But in Isaiah 13, there's many other passages in the Old Testament. What you see is that this language is used not to describe the literal end of the world, but is used to describe very, and you Wright would use this language, this worldly events here and now that are distinctly not the end of the world, but in order to help us see what's really going on in them. Isaiah 13 was not about the end of the world. Isaiah 13 was about Babylon losing a military battle to another empire. And yet, it used the imagery of, and when that happens, the sun goes dark, the moon fails to give its light, the stars fall from heaven, and it's all end of the world imagery for something that was absolutely not the end of the world centuries before Jesus came on the scene. And I'm going to argue that Mark 13 is not really about the end of the world, or at least not mainly. It is about something much more specific, much more close to Jesus, something that we now look back on a long time ago and helping us to see it more clearly. Let me just give a couple of examples of how apocalyptic works. And again, it comes from the Greek word for revelation or unveiling. It helps us to see, and here's the way I would put it, that if the New York Times and Fox News or anybody else was on the scene in Isaiah 13 or on the scene in Jesus's day, they would have looked at and reported on the same events that Isaiah tells us about, that Jesus tells us about, but they would have described it in a completely different way. They would have described it as just one more nation destroying or defeating a weaker nation, one more historical tragedy, one more act of injustice, one more act of suffering and meaningless tragedy, but they would not have seen what was really going on in those moments. One example that I always love is in Joel 2, there is an apocalyptic passage that, again, uses sun going dark, moon bleeding, stars falling from the heaven, and Peter, on the day of Pentecost, gets up, and he quotes Joel 2, and he quotes the part about the sun going dark and the moon bleeding and the stars falling from heaven. And he says this, the day of Pentecost is the fulfillment of that. And if you remember the day of Pentecost in Acts 2, here's how impressive it was to the onlookers. That the disciples who were speaking in tongues and who had just received the Spirit for the first time in this new way under the new covenant were perceived by onlookers to be drunk at about 9 o'clock in the morning. That's how impressive this moment was to those looking on, that it looked like the Christians that were there who just received the Spirit had just gotten hammered too early in the morning, that there was no sun going dark, literally. There was no moon bleeding. Stars didn't literally fall from heaven. It was just a way of saying what looks to you guys on the outside like a very typical event, like some guys just got drunk a little too early in the day, was actually the day of the Lord when the Spirit of God was poured out on high in fulfillment of all the prophecies. This is the day of the Lord. Isaiah was saying the same thing about Babylon. That actually was a moment that one thing we don't do as Christians with providence and in general, we don't claim that we can read off of the course of historical events God's evaluation, God's judgment. When knights during the medieval ages would say, we're going to have a joust, we're going to have a duel, and whichever one of us wins, that's who, you know, is innocent, that's who God favors, and whoever loses, that's who God's judgment on, that was a mistake, because that's not how history works. We do not look at one nation winning and another nation losing. We do not look at one individual prospering and one individual suffering and saying, and thus says the Lord. This is how God's judgment is working out in the world. Most of history is deeply ambiguous to us. To say that we can trust God for the future is not to say that we are usually in a position to interpret what is actually going on in history, but apocalyptic is about those moments. They're rare, but those moments where we actually do have the veil pulled back and we actually get to see things from God's perspective. That this moment of Babylon losing in Isaiah's day to another empire, that actually was the judgment of God on an empire that had been cruel and vindictive and violent for a long time. When in Acts 2, the Spirit was poured out and these guys spoke in tongues and looked like they were drunk to outsiders, that actually was the birth of the new covenant when the Spirit was poured out from on high. And the New York Times and Fox News would have never been able to tell that. And in my favorite example, 2 Kings 6, there's this great story where Elisha, the prophet after Elijah, goes to sleep. And in the morning, his servant boy is in a panic, kind of trying to wake him up. He says, Elisha, Elisha, get up. And Elisha's like, what's going on? Why are you waking me up so early? And he says, you need to see, we are surrounded by this army, by all these chariots, and they have come here to destroy us. And Elisha's response is almost comical, that it's basically like, this is what you woke me up for? Go away. And then, as the servant boy can't calm down, he's just so overwhelmed with fear and panic, Elisha says, do not be afraid, for those who are with us are more than those who are against us. Then he says, O Lord, open his eyes. That's literally what apocalyptic is. It's a moment where our eyes are opened to what's really going on behind the scenes. And the servant boy sees this vision of heavenly chariots on their side, on the Lord's side, far outnumbering the army that has surrounded them. And it's a different understanding. It's something that's purely living by sight, looking at the world empirically, couldn't deliver to you. It's a moment where you see things from God's perspective of what is actually going on in history. They're rare moments. They don't happen often, but Mark 13 is just such a moment. And so what is going on here? And here's the second thing. Some of you will be familiar with this. Some of you, this might be the first time you've ever heard this, and this might almost be jarring. But here's the second thing I want to argue. But even this is not the most important thing. But I think we misread everything in Mark 13 unless we see this, that Mark 13 is not about the second coming of Jesus, or at least not primarily. It is not about the end of the world. It is about the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, which took place about 40 years after Jesus spoke these words, within a generation. I want to give you quickly, and we do sermon discussion after the service each week. I would imagine we're going to have a very interesting discussion today with a lot of questions and a lot of things that we're going to want to talk about. Let me briefly for right now just give you a couple of reasons why, if you're paying attention to Mark 13 and how it works, what's actually said and what's not said, and what apocalyptic does as a genre, why it actually becomes pretty obvious that the main point, if not the only point, is about the coming judgment upon the temple in Jerusalem, which did in fact happen within a generation, and not about the end of the world. Here's the first reason. Look at chapter 13, 1 through 4. The initiating context and the framing question is Jesus walks out of the temple. One of his disciples says, whoa, this building is super impressive. Like, this thing is big. And it really was. It was one of the wonders of the ancient world. Like, the temple in Jerusalem was fantastic. People came just to see it. It was an impressive building. And Jesus responds by saying, yeah, this whole thing's coming down. Which leads to the question in verse 4, when's that going to happen, Jesus? Notice nothing has been said about the end of the world. Nothing has been said about Jesus. Like, they don't even get at this point that he's going to die and rise again. They're certainly not thinking about, and much later on, he's going to come again. This is about the temple and about the claim that Jesus has made, which, if you remember from these last 3 or 4 weeks, this is the second reason. Almost everything Jesus has been talking about from Mark 11, when he first entered the city of Jerusalem in the last week of his life, has been about the temple. And it's been about the failure of the temple, and specifically the religious leaders who run the temple, to be the fruitful vineyard that it was supposed to be. And in his, it's often called his cleansing of the temple, back in Mark 11, where he puts together the court of whips, and he turns over the tables, and he casts the money changers out. That's not really about cleansing the temple. It was a prophetic, symbolic act of shutting the temple down, which itself was symbolic of this, that everything that happens here is about to come to a stop, that God is going to put an end to the injustice, the hypocrisy, and the idolatry that has marked this place for so long. And Jesus quotes Jeremiah 7, which itself was about the destruction of an earlier temple, much earlier on. And then, of course, with the parable of the vineyard, what will the owner do after the son comes, with all the other prophets and servants having been rejected before him, and then the beloved son comes, and they kill him, and they throw him out of the vineyard, what will the owner do? He will come, and he will destroy those tenants, and then he will give it to others. And then Jesus quotes Psalm 118 about a cornerstone that has been rejected by human beings, Jesus, but on the basis of which a new building will be built. There'll be a new temple after this temple is torn down. Almost everything Jesus has said in these chapters has been about the temple, not about the end of the world in a more distant sense. Third reason, if you look at verse 28 in chapter 13, maybe this stood out to you. Almost out of nowhere, Jesus pulls in an illustration and says in verse 28, from the fig tree, learn its lesson. The fig tree has already shown up multiple times in chapter 11, and Jesus saw the fig tree. It was supposed to have fruit on it, but it was barren, and then he cursed it. And then afterwards, Peter points it out, and he says, well, no fruit is ever going to come from this again. But what was supposed to happen in the temple, forgiveness and God hearing your prayer and responding to your prayer, that will now happen around Jesus' own name. Around Jesus' people, the fig tree was an illustration of the temple in chapter 11, and I don't think that's changed. This is another reminder that it is about the temple. Let me give a couple of other reasons. In verses 14 through 23, we're told those who are in Judea when this happens. Why are those in Judea singled out? Like, what about people in China and New Jersey and, like, Brazil? Or at the very least, in places that they know, like Egypt and you know, Babylon, that if this is the end of the world, which is how we often hear it, why is it specifically relevant for those in Judea? And even more significantly, think about the instructions. Pray that it wouldn't happen in winter. Why would that matter if it's the end of the world? Pray that your women would not be pregnant. Why would that matter if this is the second coming? And when it happens, run. Can you imagine Jesus giving instructions that if this is the second coming, what you're supposed to do is run when you see it happen? And yet Jesus says, when you see this happening, run, pray that it not be in winter, and pray that women not be pregnant or nursing infants. And the whole assumption is something is still to come on the other side of this. This is not the end. Even when he says, not only has nothing ever been worse than this before, but nothing will ever be worse of it again, that means that there's still other stuff is coming in the future to compare it to. And then, most importantly, is in verses 29 to 31, and this has really caused a lot of problems for Christians who think this is about the end of the world or about the second coming primarily, is Jesus says, all of this all of this, which means that it has to include the previous paragraph, verses 24 to 27, the sun going dark, the moon not giving us light, the stars falling on them. All of this will take place within a generation. And again, I know I need to kind of stay on target for the big picture, but every time that word, this generation, shows up, it absolutely means that generation. You cannot spiritualize that word away. It cannot mean humanity in general. It can't mean a generation in the future. It means this generation will not pass away until all of this takes place. And then Jesus ups the ante even more and says, I'm going to stake my reputation on this one. Heaven and earth will one day pass away, but what I've said here today, these words will not pass away. You can take this to the bank, which means if this fails to be true, Jesus loses his credibility. And I have heard some very labored, very unpersuasive takes on how this doesn't actually mean within a generation, but it does. And this is how the language is always used. And all of it will take place within a generation. But again, when you see the temple raise the question, Jesus is using imagery about the temple, the abomination of desolation, the coming of the Son of Man. That's from Daniel. And that was about the temple back then, that Antiochus came in and desecrated. And something like that is going to happen again. And again, historically, it's important for us to know that within a generation, in 70 AD, the Roman Empire, responding to the kinds of events that Jesus describes here, lots of conflicts, lots of famines, lots of just conflict and just craziness going on in the world, constant rebellions against Rome by the Jewish people. In 70 AD, and those were the beginning of the birth pangs, in 70 AD, Caesar had finally had enough, and he sent his army into Jerusalem, and they burned it to the ground, but specifically, they destroyed the temple. And many of you will know this. In the last 2,000 years, the temple has never been rebuilt. That was the end of the temple in Jerusalem, in Israel. Even Judaism itself had to morph into being rabbinic Judaism, Judaism based on the law rather than on the temple and on sacrifice, because this building was destroyed by the Romans and never rebuilt again. What Mark 13 is doing, among other things, is saying, don't suspect at that moment in history was just one more natural disaster, so to speak. Just one more kind of up and down in the long course of human history. This was, as Jesus himself has already described it in Mark 12 with the parable of the vineyard, this was the Lord acting in judgment against his own people, against his own house, for not only the culminating act of the crucifixion of Jesus, but for the long history of our unfaithfulness, not listening to the prophets, or not listening heart of heart to God's law, that this was God's judgment upon us, his own people. That's what this moment really was. There are a lot of disasters like this in human history. Our history books are full of them. Most of them, the vast majority of them, we have no right to say that we know that it was God's judgment against one group vindicating another group. This passage claims that this moment was a divine interruption, a divine intervention in history, and on that day, it was the day of the Lord. It looked to Fox News and the New York Times like it was just a stronger empire, Rome, beating up a smaller empire, Judea, but it was actually the manifestation of God's own act in the world to break down what had become toxic and poisonous, but then on the basis of this rejected cornerstone to begin building something new. And so last thing I'm going to say about this, and then we'll end with what I think is the most important part of this passage. You might wonder, man, it sounds really negative, sounds really judgmental, and a lot of it is. This is one of those judgment of God passages, but this is finally hopeful. If you want to, if you're not yet persuaded, Matthew 24 is the parallel to this in Matthew, and it expands upon it some. And Luke 21 is the parallel in Luke. Luke is pretty clearly written to Gentiles. Luke is maybe even a Gentile. We don't know for sure, but probably is. Matthew is certainly Jewish, and it's a gospel written for Jewish Christians. And in Luke's version, I often say that it's kind of apocalyptic for dummies, because us Gentiles, as opposed to the Jewish people, we don't use apocalyptic, and so it's not our native tongue as Gentiles. And if you look at Luke 21's parallel, instead of saying in Mark 13, verse 14, but when you see the abomination of desolation standing where it ought not, Luke completely removes that and has Jesus say instead, "But when you see armies surrounding Jerusalem," Luke makes very explicit what is being said here in Mark 13. This is not about the end of the world. This is about what the Roman Empire would do within a generation on the basis of God's handing over his own people in their disobedience, in their long track record of unfaithfulness, our unfaithfulness to judgment. And so you could just hear it as, okay, it's just that, and it's at least that. But I want to suggest, and let me put it this way, verse 36, that last paragraph, verses 32 to 37, if the ultimate future is in view here at all, it's in view there. I do think a decent argument can be made that when Jesus says, but concerning that day or hour, singular, every other time period has been those days, those times, and that Jesus knows when it's going to happen and can kind of predict all the things that are going to happen. And here he says, but concerning that day, seemingly a different day, singular, that hour, I don't know nothing, right? Like only the Father knows. I can't tell you anything. The only thing I can tell you is that you have no idea when it will come and that you need to stay awake. I do think a good argument can be made that Jesus is now looking farther down history. But that's not what most of the chapter is about. But what I want us to notice is it is very possible that Mark was written right after 70 AD. Some people would put it in a couple of years before 70 AD, some people right after. But if this is only about the temple, if this is even just mainly about the temple, it lost its relevance really quickly. It had a short shelf life because for the vast majority of us in history, this has been a past tense event, not a future tense event. And yet Jesus breaks the fourth wall in the final statement of the chapter and says, what I've told these disciples about this moment here, I am now telling all of you forever. Stay awake because you don't know the time. And here's what I want us to notice in our last 5 minutes or so. Hannah, would you put up on our screen the chart that I sent you? This will be sent around to you guys later on. Feel free to take some notes now if you want. What I want you to notice as Hannah puts this up on the screen, is all the parallels between Mark 13 here and what is going to happen in Mark 14 and 15 in the next two chapters. That Jesus is describing the future in Mark 13, not in a random way, not in an arbitrary way, but as, I'm going to put it this way, as a constant repetition for his later followers of what he is about to experience in Mark 14 and Mark 15 in his passion. In his cross, that so to speak, and it's in that Leslie Newbegin quote at the beginning of our bulletin today, that what apocalyptic really does is says how God has acted here in history, because God is faithful and God is consistent and he's unchanging, becomes the template, becomes the paradigm for how he will continue to act in the future. It doesn't mean that we can guess ahead of time what's coming, but it does mean that even though the future will always surprise us, it will always come to us as essentially unknown and unpredictable, then nonetheless, we should, if we know who God is and how he acts in the world, the future should always be recognizable to us as it arrives, even though we can't predict it ahead of time, because there are certain patterns in how God providentially, to use that word, acts in history that Jesus has said. Again, verse 23, be on guard. I've told you everything beforehand. I'm going to put that as I've told you everything you really need to know before it happens. This doesn't mean that we can guess what's coming in tomorrow's newspaper, but it does mean that what we essentially need to know to be ready for the future, Jesus has told us here. And what we need to know about the future is that the story of Jesus will continue to be the story of the church. So you can see it here. I even encourage you, as we work through Mark 14 and 15 in the next few weeks leading up to Easter, to be noticing this. Jesus talks about, I'm just going to mention a few here, and then I'll send this around later, and you can look it up on your own. Everything that Jesus describes is happening in the future in Mark 13 first happens to him in the next couple of chapters. He is handed over and betrayed. And not just by people in general, but by his own family and friends, Judas and his followers. He is led before both a Jewish council and Gentile kings and governors, and he bears witness to the gospel in front of them. The elect are led astray. We are about to, and I know we all know this, but we are about to read a lot of stories of Peter and the other disciples being led astray and being faithless, even in this hour of trial and tribulation. Jesus will be beaten. The same word for you will be beaten is used four times of Jesus in the passion scene You'll be beaten. You'll be put to death. It's exactly what happened to Jesus. The hour has come, Jesus says in Gethsemane. And here it's the hour. You need to be ready for the hour. And it's near. It's at hand. In fact, to end, I want you to go to Mark 14. All of Mark 14 and 15 has overtones of Jesus experiencing in his own story what he says the future will constantly hold for us in the generations to come. But one place where you really see it is in Gethsemane, starting in Mark 14, verse 32. I want you to notice, one, that Jesus tells them to stay awake. They're sleepy. And this is a moment of trial. It is a moment of tribulation or temptation, the same word. And he tells them to stay awake. And I think you remember the story. Three times they fall asleep. And I want you to notice, first, Mark 13, verse 36, the end of the Olivet Discourse, our passage today, says, stay awake lest he come suddenly and find you sleeping. That's why you need to stay awake. Lest he come find you sleeping. Gethsemane. Chapter 14, verse 37, and he came and found them sleeping. The exact same phrase at the end of Mark 13. Then again, he says, watch. It's literally the verb for stay awake. Same verb from Mark 13, stay awake. Verse 37, verse 38, stay awake. And then we're told, verse 40, and again, the Son of Man came and found them sleeping. It's not to say that Mark 13 was about Gethsemane, or only about Gethsemane. It's saying, here's one really practical application. Mark 13 is reminding us that we are always in Gethsemane, that we are always called to stay awake with our Lord, to watch for his coming, and to know that there are things inside of us, that the spirit might be willing, but the flesh is weak, and that we will always be tempted to fall asleep, to be led astray, to not be paying attention to what's really important in the world, and that the Son of Man will come. And it better not be that he finds us sleeping, that we are always in Gethsemane with Jesus, always in Gethsemane with the disciples. And here is another one. And I don't know if you've ever thought about this. The first time I saw this, I found it so eye-opening. What happens when Jesus is dying on the cross? The sun goes dark. There is an earthquake. The temple veil is torn in two. Symbolically, even though the temple didn't literally fall for another 40 years, on the cross, the temple was destroyed and was no longer the place where God met with his people. The cross was the destruction of the temple. The cross was literally kind of like the end of the world, that one world came to an end, the world of sin and death, of darkness and sin reigning over us. And a new world was born at his resurrection. We literally meet on Sundays now rather than Saturdays because there's a new creation week. But that's what was really going on. If the New York Times had been there, if Fox News had been there, they would have written on page 68 that some insignificant Jewish teacher had been crucified like thousands of other Jews by the Roman Empire. And what Mark is saying is, this is actually the day of the Lord. This is actually the day when God judges human sin by taking it upon himself. This is actually the day where he liberates his people and gathers them from the four corners of the earth. This leads to mission. This is actually the day where God reaches his hand into history and directly sets right what has gone wrong. That's what actually happened at the cross. And not only that, but that's what will continue to be the template, that we will continue to have the same temptations Jesus had during his own life. That's one of the many reasons we still read the Gospels. It's not just a story of what happened long ago. It's still our story today. We are still tempted in every way Jesus was tempted, in precisely the same ways. We are still faced with brothers and sisters who either fall away from the faith and turn against us, or who are led astray. Church history is filled with Christians. I have been led astray many times in my life, that we are regularly confronted with this, and we are regularly confronted with the world not understanding, even being hostile against the gospel, and yet we are called not to cause suffering, but to suffer as we bear witness to Jesus by loving those around us. And like Jesus, and like this first generation, we are called to endure to the end. So final thing that I want you to notice, and then we'll end, is in Mark 13 at the very end, and this one to me really seals it. Maybe you're persuaded by what I've said, maybe not, but to me this one really caps it off. Jesus says in verse 35 of Mark 13, therefore stay awake, for you do not know when the master of the house will come. And then he gives four periods of time that's really easy to miss and just read over. But he says he might come in the evening, he might come at midnight, he might come when the rooster crows. That one should really jump out at us. Or he might come in the morning. I encourage you as we continue through Mark in the weeks to come to notice that not only are those four time indicators, the four time indicators that structure the passion story of Jesus in Mark 14 and 15, but they show up in that order. The Last Supper is evening. Gethsemane is midnight. The next morning, very early in the morning, the next thing that happens is Peter denies Jesus and the rooster crows, and then Jesus rises from the dead on Sunday morning. These time periods are getting us ready to hear that the Lord could come at any point. The Lord did come in his death and his resurrection. He did come when the temple was destroyed, and he will come again. What Jesus said to them, he says to all of us, stay awake. Stay awake. This is always for us. It's not to say that this passage is about our future directly, but it does set a template that will always be recognizable in our experience. The dangers in Mark 13 are always our dangers in every generation. The promises in Mark 13 that you're not alone, that the Spirit will be with you, that there'll be mission to engage in, that you'll have brothers and sisters that also stay faithful with you, that there's a promise of enduring the end. Those will always be our promises. And the story of Jesus will always set the template for what the story of the church should be. Those are our priorities. Those are our criteria. And so as George MacDonald, who we've been reading some about in The Great Divorce, says, what matters in these passages in the Gospels is not that you can guess ahead of time when the end is. In fact, these passages dissuade us against that. They warn us against trying to guess. Instead, what they remind us is that the one thing that matters is whenever the end is, that we were faithful along the way, that we stayed awake, that we were true by God's grace to the work that he entrusted to us, and that we stayed on mission. We avoided distractions. We were not disheartened by sufferings, but that with the Lord, we stayed awake, lest he come suddenly and find us asleep. So let's pray that we would be a church that always stays awake.